Well, thank you very much indeed. That was really rich, and I think it's given us a lot of new sort of angles on the Met Department, perhaps, or sort of ways in or ways of engaging more richly. I'm wondering if you'd be up for some questions, if you will.
Yeah, if you guys are up for them. I don't want to go. What time do you usually go?
Not to 10, 10.
Oh, well, I won't make it. People are flagging, do you know, don't show, sit there to the bitter end. But anyway, yeah, we'll just see what questions come. But already.
I've always been fascinated by myths that try and explain the seasons and what goes on in the Western world, where you have, you know, spring, summer, autumn, winter. And the scenes as well. And maybe the scenes sort of belong, they belong underneath, in the darkness. And I'm interested in your comments and observations about plant life and the richness of that. Well, things have to go up and go down, and the nutrients come up.
And
we pretend funny things about the soil, but actually the soil is really important.
Yeah.
And I read some fact that I could not believe, because we know very little about the microorganisms that live in soil. There is a whole other world that we either ignore, and we've ignored at our peril.
Yeah.
I mean, in reality, as a reality rather than as a metaphor.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I'm just, you've got me going on the metaphor of it. I feel like there is something I feel quite strongly about, but it's not literally soil, but it, in a way, it is the soil of our culture. Actually, and it's to do with this image of the Dharma coming into new culture, into the Western culture, and in a way, it's quite a sort of lively, debated issue about what are you bringing in, and what does it grow into, and how much is just the Dharma, and how much is just parts of Eastern sort of psyche or mythology that we're bringing in our belief system. And I suppose I just partly, I said this at the beginning, part of the reason why I'm kind of interested in Western myths is I just sort of feel like actually we've got so much in terms of the soil, Western soil, that the Dharma can grow into. And I kind of just got a sense, maybe it's just me, but I don't know whether we or I value it enough. Yeah, that actually there's all this richness there. And I have a very strong feeling around ancestors and ancestry. Yeah, is that somehow... what do I say about this? That somehow it's sort of important for me to have a sense of connection through ancestry. This is literally my sort of biological and social sort of soil that I grow out of. And again, I wouldn't be what I am if it wasn't for all of that that's gone before. So in my mind, all of that is implicitly supportive of my Dharma practice. It is not set against my Dharma practice. It supports it. And I suppose I sometimes wonder whether an idea of sort of somehow it's not supportive and we have to get away from that to something else. And I just think, actually, there's so much that's deeply supportive in that, for me, that image of ancestry. And it can be mixed, it kind of depends on your past, but nonetheless, none of us would be here if it wasn't for all of that that had gone before. And there's something about that soil, and literally my ancestors are in the soil, it's what I grow out of, and it's what I'll go back into. That's... I don't know where I quite answered your question, but there is something around that.
So it's more time team than agriculture, is it?
More?
Time team than agriculture.
Maybe, yeah.
I think that sense of place and how we relate to the landscape or anything.
Yeah.
The other thought I had was about down. Down can be a view of equanimity. When you're up, you're looking down. When you're in a high mountain, you see below you. Sometimes people go up in a sense in order to get away and go down, if that makes any sense. if people are living sort of there, we don't go down, we don't go up there either.
Yeah.
When you go up,
yeah,
as well, you also sort of exploring the unknown and going to hidden places.
Yeah. I think you need kind of both, don't you? I mean, in a way, I'm just going for down because I like that metaphor, but I think you do need both in the sense of there's a view or a perspective or something you get from, you know, looking down, as it were, that's actually quite important. You're not lost in the midst of things, yeah. But then there's also an intimacy, a closeness that we need to live out, love, what it is to love. And I think both of those are there in some way, aren't they?
When you were talking, two words kept coming back in my head, rooted and grounded.
Mm.
And after I first thought them, I realised they were about down very much, and they related to what you're saying about morality and having a value. Or
And I think those words are both very useful just in meditation as well, sort of suggestions. Quite often people use them, don't they, sense of being rooted down into the earth or grounded. Mm. Something about that imagery is very helpful, I think. Mm.
I'm reminded of the tree as a kind of pagan symbol, and I think in Nordic cultures it's revered, this famous tree, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, Yggdrasil.
Whenever it's shown, it's the root and the branches.
Yes.
And then I was thinking about how, you know, in winter the tree is great, their roots, and in the summer the energy is on the top, but it's a bit like Persephone spending out the year above and below, you know, where you put your energy and your nurturance, and then something about integration as well. But there's just this, you know, there's this ongoing cycle that never stops, really.
Yes.
So you're going to reach depth and you're going to reach heights, but you're not going to stay in space.
Yeah, I mean, the tree's a lovely image. What I really enjoyed is that the Shakya clan apparently were tree worshippers. I really thought it was fantastic. Of course they were. You know, think of all the times that the tree appears in the Buddha's life, you know, and it's like, well, apparently the tree's not actually there, is it? In the earliest accounts of his enlightenment, that tree is not there that he's enlightened under. It appears later. So it's probably an archetypal tree, not an actual tree, yeah, which kind of suggests, it's a bit like you're saying, it's like it stands for awakening, doesn't it, in some sort of way. You know, and it just appears right the way through the Buddha's life, you know, and he dies, doesn't he, between trees. So there's something very kind of interesting, important just about that image. And I think I love the fact that, you know, with tree worship, you know, it's a universal thing, isn't it, tree worship, so it kind of feels like that's something which it makes an easy sort of connection in some ways. We didn't have to be Bodhi trees, we've got lovely oak trees and things. Yeah, works the same. Mm.
I was really struck by Hermes, he's also somebody that I've come more into contact with in these last couple of years. And when you were saying about the relationship of Metta Bhavana, Hermes is also about retrograde, Metta Bhavana, or just practice generally, thinking can mean that you have to go back.
Okay. Yeah.
That's certainly my experience.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were saying about practicing Metta Bhavana, or I'd say probably practicing generally.
Yeah.
It's, you're contacting unresolved grief, you know, there is this need to go back.
Yeah, so that's the backwards and the down, and then the downwards.
Downwards
bit.
There's another great book actually, which I found very helpful in this last couple of years, which is called In Midlife. It's about midlife transition. A therapeutic union analyst, but yeah, he talks a lot about Hermes and that particular journey in an archetypal way.
Mm.
Mm.
you seen before?
I just want to hear about the myth and the role of myth. Reminded me of a quote from great mythologist Joseph Campbell.
Mm.
He said that in his view, the one thing that was the biggest sort of problem in our Western culture is that we didn't have a shared myth, you know, in cultures that have evolved, depending on myths as their stories, as their source of values and beliefs. And these sort of myths help define their relationship to each other and to the land, and to help them survive in some of the most inhospitable times and climates, like the Aborigines, for instance. You know, survived 100,000 years in one of the most inhospitable regions on Earth. They have a really refined and defined relationship to each other, to the land, to the community. Well, it did until Western powers went in there and changed all of that. But there's this sort of understanding that by, you know, religion plays, organised religion played a certain part in providing myths, shared myths for certain communities and things, but as we've become more sort of segregated and secular as a society, those themselves have sort of dissipated away. There's this understanding that, you know, with the challenges we're facing now in our culture, something like a shared myth could really help us, you know, to reconnect with that in whatever form that takes. I don't know how. Quite an interesting perspective.
Yes, I mean, yes, and we kind of don't know, and hopefully that something like that is unfolding. I find it a bit hard to know at the moment, but, you know.
I think we've become so materialistic, so focused on the
temple. It's kind of like that is our myth almost, isn't it? I think.
We can't prove it in the laboratory, it didn't happen, it has no relevance, you know. So
Off
it goes, and yet, in the space of the last couple of hundred years, we've almost wiped ourselves off the planet, so. Which is the more wholesome approach to life, you know. Definitely embracing the teachings that we get through the myths.
Maybe we need to create one.
I think so,
In that little tale, at any point does she have sort of free will about what she actually does, or does she have to just do what she's told?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's not like I've looked at a huge number of variants, but she seems strangely neutral or ambiguous. It's interesting, isn't it? She, it's like you could read all sorts of things into her, but it's not obvious what she makes of anything. It's almost like it's everyone else who's having the responses, but not her. I don't know quite what that means. I just find it when a character's sort of more ambivalent or ambiguous, I just find that quite interesting, because it does suggest actually it's almost like you're being invited to read it many different ways. Just part of what's great about myth is that it offers you the possibility of having a whole range of perspectives. So there isn't this sort of, you have to see it like this, this is the right way.
Make you think carefully when you go pick a flat.
I really liked when you just quite simply said that sorrow is closely related to empathy. Just you saying that out loud. Because I think my practice so far has largely been about embracing my own sorrow, but the beauty of it. So it's not something to push away and, you know, I forget that because there's, you know, there's happier stuff. Just embracing it actually as humanness and beauty. And when I'm amidst my sorrow with metta, I feel like I really connect with people, really relate to people.
Exactly.
My friends and family and the families that I see. I notice that that happens the most when I'm deeply within my own sorrow. I was really, of everything you said, which was wonderful, That one sentence really moved me.
Because
like we can know these things like in experience, but sometimes saying the right line touches something else.
That is The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. And it's very, very good. It's a huge chapter on right and left brain hemispheres, neurophysiology, which is, you know, but if you can wade through that, it's kind of fascinating.
That's a TED talk, so you can watch that section.
Oh right, right.
So you watch it,
that's
true.
Okay.
But the book's great.
You cheat,
great.
Cheating.
Yeah. One of the reviewers of the book said, "Didn't think anybody else could have written it, but Ian McGilchrist."
Yeah.
It's sort of analysis of all the classical, all the classical period right down to now,
yeah.
And then the neuroscience they try to put it together. It's like three books in one.
It's quite.
It's looking up on the internet. It's quite a lot of stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, it's quite a feat what he's done, tried to do in that book. But he is, I mean, again, you got a split, you know, he's saying that the brain is almost entirely split in two. I find it interesting, the heart, you know, is also split in two. We have got this sort of dual sort of split aspect to us, which is just very interesting what the implications are, you know, and he maps out the implications for how we see the world. You know, we have two completely different ways of viewing the world, of being in the world, depending on, well, in this case, which part of the brain we're coming from, and so much comes out of that. It's quite extraordinary. Anyway, if you're interested. Yeah.
Okay. So shall we wind it up there?
Yeah, I think
so
we should.
So one last round of applause and thanks to Mark.